from a very rainy Seattle, Washington. This is the Fretboard Journal podcast, and I am Jason Verlinde, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal magazine. And if you've been listening to this podcast for any amount of time, you probably know that is John Rauhaus playing in the background. I want to thank everybody for listening to the podcast, and I want to thank everybody who bought the Fretboard Journal in November or subscribed to the magazine in November. We had our best month ever. And I know that a ton of folks who listen to this podcast place their orders because you use the coupon code podcast and saved a few bucks off your order, which you can still do. But I just want to thank everybody. We had such a great, positive November. It was just what the doctor ordered. We are going to be able to do a whole bunch of new projects in 2018 that we weren't able to do in 2017. Maybe some new podcast shows and a lot more. So thank you. A ton of folks signed up for. We did a, we still are offering it actually, a 3-year subscription deal for $99. A ton of folks signed up for that. A ton of folks placed gift subscriptions. And please keep those orders coming. We want to have just as equally a good December and close out this year in style. Speaking of style, today I'm talking to Joel Patterson, who has just released one of the great Christmas guitar records, in my humble opinion. It is called Hi-Fi Christmas. It is on Bloodshot Records. It sounds like a classic Les Paul instrumental record, but it is all Joel. It's all from 2017. He tells us a little bit about how he put this record together. It sounds like it was a shit ton of work. He tells us about the gear that went into it and a lot more. I hope you enjoy it. We had a great chat. In addition to being super busy with the tape gun around here and getting our 41st issue ready for press, I have to share a quick story. I don't often share stories from my life, but on Tuesday of this week, I drove 2.5 hours down to Olympia, Washington, which should have been an hour-long drive, but that's Washington traffic for you, to see a band that is very close to my heart, Jawbreaker. Jawbreaker is a punk pop band that was very important to me around 25 years ago. They broke up around 21 years ago. This was their fourth show since kind of reuniting this year. It's still a little nebulous as to whether they've officially reunited or not, but they were together, all three of them. I just had a great time. Some folks go to see the Eagles to tap into their childhood. For me, this tapped into my childhood and the very influential period of my late teens and early 20s when guitar was starting to become very important in my life, and I was starting to think about gear, and music was, you know, it's always been important to me, but Jawbreaker just had a huge influence and impact on me, and they delivered. They did not play my favorite song, Chesterfield King, but they sounded great, and I just, I left that show with a big smile on my face and feeling so good about music and the power of music, and it made me want to go buy a Les Paul and a Marshall Plexi and sound like Blake, the front man, but I haven't done that yet. I'm tempted, but anyways, yeah, I just want to say that go see your favorite band. Go get out of the house, even if it's rainy, and even if you have to drive a long way, and tap into that feeling, because it's been a while for me. I see music all the time, but not stuff that had such a big impact on me when I was younger. Anyhow, speaking of Marshalls, our sponsor today is Retrofit Vintage Guitars, and while you were shopping on Amazon on Cyber Monday or eating Thanksgiving leftovers, I think these guys were on some sort of amp buying spree. I don't know where all these amps came from, but their whole new arrivals page is loaded with cool amps right now. They have a 1975 Marshall Mercury, which I have to be honest, I really want this amp. I hope no one buys it out from under me. Go ahead and buy it out from under me. I don't need this amp, but I really, really want it. A 37 Rickenbacker Professional, a 1957 Fender Princeton, a 65 Gretsch 6150, and so much more. I've barely scratched the surface. They also have a blonde 66 Strat for sale right now, a 1948 Gibson ES-125, and a 64 Gibson SG Special in cherry red. Retrofret has so much. You should just go to retrofret.com, click on their new arrivals page, poke around. You are going to find something that will speak to you. By all means, if you ever need any restoration or repair work, you should reach out to them. They do incredible work, world-class repair work. If somebody wants to make my day, you can buy me that Marshall for Christmas. I'll play a lot of Jawbreaker songs for you. Anyways, Visit their showroom in Brooklyn. Don't be shy. Tell them the Fretboard Journal sent you if you do have any queries about any of their gear. And once again, go to retrofret.com or go to their Instagram page, which is just retrofret, and see what they are all about. You will love them. No other plugs today. I just want to thank you guys once again for subscribing to the magazine, helping us out, and being a part of our extended tribe. We love it. Keep the feedback coming. Keep the iTunes reviews coming for this podcast. It all helps us out. Next week, I'm going to be talking to Kurt Block, sort of a local punk rock legend here in Seattle, who obviously was a guitarist for the Fastbacks. He's produced a lot of great records, and I can't wait to talk to him. I hope you enjoy our conversation with Joel Patterson. In the meantime, once again, his album is called Hi-Fi Christmas. Go get it. Go stream it. It is a great Christmas record. Thanks, everybody. Joel, thanks for talking to us. I've been a fan of your music for many years now, and you just put out a Christmas record. And before we talk about all that other stuff, why did you put out Hi-Fi Christmas Guitar?
Well, I kind of have this thing where I've been recording a Christmas song here or there for the last few years. A couple years ago, I actually got motivated on Christmas, which I think that's where it started, because I was home. I stayed home for Christmas. I was an orphan on Christmas, and I was getting a little stir crazy, and I actually recorded like this multi-track version of White Christmas and threw it up on YouTube just as a way to say Merry Christmas to everybody, and it was kind of fun, and people said, you should make a record, and every year I've kind of added another tune here or there, and then I realized I'm never going to get a Christmas record out in 14 years at this rate, so I need to actually do this in the summertime, which is not easy to do. So this year I actually made myself do it. Around June I started looking for Christmas songs and kicking around arrangements and looking for ideas and forced myself to stay motivated. It was not easy.
What was the actual recording session like for these? I imagine I'm sure you're a fan of vintage gear, but walk me through how this actual record came to be.
Well, it's kind of hard to describe. I mean, it's a multi-track record in the tradition of Les Paul, who pretty much invented the guitar multi-tracking records. And in the late 40s and early 50s, he made these records, which were like guitar orchestras with a zillion guitar parts. And I've always been fascinated by these and how he made these records. And there were some other people that carried this on, like Buddy Merrill, made some crazy multi-track recordings in the 60s. And probably my favorite guy that nobody knows about around here is Jörgen Ingman, who recorded a famous version of Apache that people know. But he was a Danish amazing jazz guitar player who made some jazz records in the 50s and early 60s that were multi-tracked. And these are kind of my favorite records. So along with the early Les Paul and Jörgen Ingman, that kind of inspired me to make these Christmas arrangements. And it's not easy to describe how I recorded them, because every track has about 20 guitar parts on them, and so it's kind of the sessions are kind of laborious and maybe not that interesting to talk about, but basically I recorded all the guitar parts myself, and Alex Hall recorded the drums and bass in his great studio, and it was a long, slow process to arrange all those tunes, because the Christmas songs are not easy. Like the classic ones are written by a great jazz and big band arrangers. So just to try to make my own arrangements and find the right guitar sounds and pick the right guitars, and a lot of trial and error. That's all I can really, how I describe it.
And are you recording these guitar parts digitally, or are you using an analog setup?
Yeah, I'm recording them on Pro Tools, but I just use Pro Tools as a tape recorder, which I think it's totally fine for that purpose. I mean, I'm basically just recording, using it to record WAV files. But really, the sound is me just messing around forever with the right mic placement and the right amp and the right guitar and the right attack and the right everything. That's the real secret to get that sound.
Yeah. And do you
and then when we mixed it, there's a lot of things that we did when we mixed it, you know, to put it through some tape and break it out in the analog domain, and then do some analog summing and going through tape and everything to kind of, but I think a lot of that is I think really the playing of the rhythm section in me is really kind of what gives it that sound.
Yeah.
There aren't any digital effects. There's no added digital plugins, nothing. Avoided that. Everything is... So everything in my mind is analog except for the actual, final step of recording it onto a tape recorder, but you'd be pretty hard to tell the difference at that step.
Yeah. And when you're trying to wrap your head around these arrangements, I know you said some of these songs have like 25 guitar parts that you played all of them.
Maybe more. I haven't even counted them yet.
Do you have all that worked out before you start the... No. Okay.
No. Sometimes I do. I have like a plan, but like the thing about recording like that, and why I'm really amazed at Les Paul, like how he did that on whatever technique he invented on tape to do it. I can't even envision how he did that. I'm always amazed by him.
Yeah.
And I planned them out in my head and kind of messed around with it. I had an idea, but if you ever get married to an idea and you start doing it, you start to try to put a, square peg in a round hole. I think that's the right expression. But, if you have it all worked out and then it's not working, you got to just scrap everything because that's the... And I did that a lot. And that's the laborious part about recording these multi-track things. You can work for a whole week on a tune, and if it doesn't feel right, you just erase it, I did that a lot. And it's Christmas, so the tunes had to have a nice feel to them,
Oh, yeah. And you had a deadline. I guess
yes,
you had to wait.
Yes, I had a firm deadline. I have never had such a firm deadline in my life, which was good. And I had to try to get it out somewhat before Christmas, so people had a chance to buy it. So, yes, it was going to be... I had some moments where I did not know if I was going to finish this record because I had a really heavy gig schedule this summer. And there was times where I was playing every night for a month and locking myself in the room in the day and recording and running off to gigs, and my brain totally scrambled and not able to learn songs for my gigs. And so, yeah, it was a stressful process. So hopefully you put it on and relax and have a nice feeling with it. And don't imagine me torturing myself when you listen to it.
I've listened to it several times now and never thought of the agony you must have gone through. Was one tune particularly hard, or were you beating yourself over one tune over another, or were they all kind of...
They're all pretty complicated. Yeah. I spent a lot of time on all of them. Some of them I think were hard because I had a different idea and it was hard for me to let go of it. And then finally, when I found the right idea, it was nice. So, I like them all. I thought maybe I was going to put 12 songs on there, but I ended up with 14 that I liked and I had a hard time picking which ones to delete. And some of them are kind of hybrids of some of the tracks I recorded on Christmas and Christmas Eve. Couple years ago, some of the actual tracks were done on Christmas, so I thought that's authentic.
Yeah, that is. So, on any given track, there might be 30 guitar tracks, but what on any given song, how many guitars are on each song? Or did you stick to one guitar per song, or did you mix that up?
No, there's no rhyme or reason to it. it's all just me finding the right tune. I had a good time. I'm obsessed with guitar tone, and I wanted to find the right sound for every track that spoke to me, and sometimes I had an idea and I was like, nah, this isn't working. And they're all done. It's kind of boring for me to go through and say exactly what I did. And I'd like to leave a little mystery in it, but sure. I think anybody that follows me on Instagram sees my guitars, and I've posted pictures of my recording process in the summer. I was making posts like, help, I'm not going to finish this record. So I basically showed you my guitar setup. It's an old RCA ribbon mic and a little Gibson amp and a Fender reverb tank from the 60s and an Echoplex and a bunch of Gibson archtops. And that's how I recorded it. And my 295 that you see a lot of photos of me and mm-hmm. the record cover, that's the lead part on much of it. And, but there's also an Epiphone Broadway that's on a lot of it. And there's one tune that's kind of interesting. I got My Love to Keep Me Warm as a jazz song, kind of a big band arrangement. But every guitar on that song is a Les Paul. I have a 69 gold top that I put 50s pickups in. And everything you hear on I've Got My Love to Keep Me Warm is a Les Paul. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
That worked out. But I used, for all the little background parts that you hear, most of those are my Les Paul in the middle position. Just because I know, I feel like Les Paul was recording a lot of his backing parts with a Les Paul to get a nice, you know, clean sound.
Sure.
So all those little incidental things and high notes and everything are usually on my Les Paul Gold Top.
And there's is there a lap steel on a couple tracks?
Yeah, it's actually table steel or straight steel, whatever you want to call it, a console. It's a Jerry Bird model Rickenbacker 8-string.
Yeah.
And then I also have a Stringmaster. There's a Stringmaster on that. And there's also actual pedal steel on the more straight-up country tunes. What's it called? Pretty Paper and Blue Christmas have a straight, you know, Emmons pedal steel on there.
Wow. Well, as with those original Les Paul recordings, the listener would never know all the work that went into them. You did a great job.
Yeah, I know. When I listen to them, it tortures me to listen to them. But Les Paul never ceases to amaze me. And he really is great at making those recordings sound spontaneous and fresh and fun. And, you know, recording them must have been just laborious, but he just always had this fresh feel to his records, which probably the all-time greatest, you know, and he invented it, so.
Yeah. You've made an entire living as a professional guitarist and working in this kind of vein, this retro. I mean, you have so many different bands, I can't even keep track, mm-hmm. but where did you grow up?
I grew up in Madison, Wisconsin.
Okay.
A couple hours north of Chicago, and I started off playing blues. I did nothing. I think of myself as a blues guitar player, no matter how fancy my guitar playing, how many jazz tunes I play. I always feel like I'm just a blues guitar player masquerading as a jazz guitar player. But I just played on the blues scene when I was a teenager, and I played on the street for tips. That was kind of my real way I learned. And all I played was country blues finger picking. You know, I was obsessed with Blind Blake and all the 1920s blues. So I already learned that alternate thumb style at a young age when I just thought it was blues playing. You know, I didn't know anything about Chet Atkins or country or anything.
Was there someone who turned you on to this music, or was there a radio station or something?
I think back then, I mean, it's just, I was just digging through record stores. I mean, it's not anything like it is today with every artist is available on YouTube. And I mean, you never saw a video of anybody back then or knew anything. You just dug through record stores, and that's how you found stuff. And you put a record onto a cassette and you tried to your best to learn it that way. So I think I just kind of over the year, I mean, I discovered Merle Travis, I think, and that was what really started me on the Western thing. And I was like, wow, this guy's playing just like Blind Blake, but it's got this country feel to it, and it's on electric. And so Merle Travis was a hero of mine. I got a lot of influences. I could talk forever about all of them, but
I love hearing them.
Bring me in.
Did you have a guitar instructor who kind of helped you find these sounds? No. Okay.
No, I took a few jazz lessons kind of early on, but they've kind of frustrated me more than anything because I was pretty set in my blues ways and I wasn't quite ready to internalize it. So everything that I know has just been some phase I went through or some stuff I had to learn for a gig or an artist that I got obsessed with or, you know, it never ends. I think that's why people play guitar. I mean, I don't think anybody plays guitar to have any thought that they know everything. You know, I think the whole point in playing guitar is to just have this lifetime of absorbing stuff and learning stuff.
Yeah.
It never ends for me.
Yeah. And do you have any new guitars or are they all old?
Yeah, pretty much all my guitars are vintage. I think, I have a couple of, put together tele projects and that kind of stuff, but, I was lucky enough to, I mean, I've been wheeling and dealing guitars since, I don't know when, the early 90s, you know, and I've just been this lifetime of trading and making bad trades, good trades, you know, buying stuff, trading up to find arch tops. And luckily, you know, arch tops have always kind of just been something that you can get, you know, if you play your cards right. And guitars just kind of find me. Every guitar I own, I just have because it came along, and I was like, this is a great guitar. I have to have this. It sounds great, you know.
Yeah.
But don't get me started about the new world of the vintage guitar market. I will.
Now let's get your thoughts.
That's a whole other podcast. Oh, it's just crazy. I feel bad for anybody starting to play guitar now that wants a good guitar sound. It's just impossible. It's not, the prices are crazy. I mean, they're not even based on anything. They're just people putting their own guitar up, you know, on the internet for a crazy asking price that you wouldn't even, I don't know. I understand the whole thing. Blue chip guitars ever since the 70s have been expensive. You know, the Les Pauls, 50 Strats, 50s Dodnecks, you know, that stuff has always been on a table and crazy, and that's fine. And you could, if you were shrewd, you could figure out how to get a nice arch top or a nice guitar with P90s or a nice 175 or the right beat up telly. But now you can't get anything because everybody thinks everything is worth $1 million, and it drives me crazy. And every time I play a gig, there's always somebody asking me what my guitar is worth. I mean, that's like the first question out of everybody's mouth. I'm just like, man, that's
that's gross.
It's depressing. What about the music? You know, it's like, really wish we could put some guitars in the hands of like some musicians, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, are you publishing this interview?
It's gonna be a podcast.
Shut up.
No, it's a podcast. It's a podcast. We
this
can
isn't
talk.
Just you and me, right? All right.
Yeah, no, we're good.
I just realize I'm saying negative things about people.
You haven't actually specifically named anybody by name, so you're okay.
I've named the internet.
You have.
I've blamed the internet.
Well,
yes.
how many different bands do you have right now? Because I know you got like a B3 trio. I mean, you have so
wait,
many.
Let me check my website. I'm not sure. I don't know. I mean, I've kind of tried to pare it down too because I was getting spread a little too thin. And I have about four or five bands right now that I'm really kind of concentrating on. And the Modern Sounds is always kind of my main band. And that's Bo Sample and Alex Hall, who are just amazing musicians. They're the rhythm section on the Christmas record.
Mm-hmm.
And we just play whatever we want, you know. I think we're a jazz band, a blues band, swing, whatever you want to call it. But that's kind of my main trio. But that band also backs up, does a lot of gigs where we're backing up a singer or featuring a different musician. And the Western Elstons is my kind of honky-tonk band I play with, that features Scott Legan and Casey McDonough, really great singers, harmony singers. They also play with NRBQ, the latest incarnation of NRBQ, and that's a fun band to play with because I can kind of play some more finger picking and country stuff. And then the organ trio I play every Sunday at the Green Mill, famous jazz club in Chicago, and I play with Chris Foreman, who is just an unbelievable musician. He's a legendary organ player. He knows every Jimmy McGriff song ever recorded, mm-hmm. and Jack McDuff and Richard Groove Holmes, and he's just an encyclopedia. And you asked me if I had any teachers. Well, trying to back him up and comp along with his organ, that's the best teacher I've ever had.
That's great.
And Devlin Woodpile. I can't forget Devlin Woodpile. I've been with this band for like 15 years. They're a country blues, 1920s blues band. I play resonator guitar, and we play at the Hideout all the time.
Nice.
I'm probably forgetting some more.
And do you teach, or are you just gigging all the time?
Sometimes I don't teach. I don't really have time. The scheduling is very, as you can see by our attempts to schedule this phone call, I have a hard time scheduling people, so I kind of gave up on the lessons. But every once in a while, I'll do an informal lesson, you know, but nothing regularly.
Yeah.
Someday I will.
All right.
Definitely no Skype lessons. I tried that once, so I don't think I'll ever do that again.
All right. And
I was
just out of curiosity, do you already have, I know you just finished this record, do you have another one in the works, or are you plotting another multi-track extravaganza?
Every time I make a multi-track record, then the next record I make is like simple. It's like, I got to play everything live.
Oh, good. Yeah.
So I think the next thing, I need to do something with the organ trio. That's been on my list. I've been putting it off forever. So I need to make a record with Chris Foreman. And that will definitely be played live.
Okay.
And I have a lot of ideas to make records. I wish I could just do that all the time. You know, I would love to make a record with the Western Elstons and Oscar Wilson, this blues singer. I'd love to do some more stuff with him. And Yeah, it never ends. Probably not another Christmas record for a while. I don't think I'm going to do Hi-Fi Christmas Volume 2 next year.
Well, you set the bar pretty high with number one, so thank you
for
doing
that.
Oh,
thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for listening to it.
Of course.
I appreciate it. It seems to be well-received. I'm curious how I've been inside my own head for so long with this record. I don't know. I have any idea yet what people are going to like about it or which tunes they're going to like, so I'm always curious about that.
Yeah.
Cause you never know what Christmas songs are going to speak to somebody, really, because it all depends on their memory of them.
Yeah, totally. Well,
you know.
Well, thanks so much for talking, Joel. This was great.
Thank you very much. I hope I answered all your questions about my gear and everything. And
I like that you wanted to keep it kind of secretive.
Well, I said that, and then I told you everything I did. So there you go. It didn't work very well. You beat it out of me. I think basically, if you look at the record cover and you flip it over and you see the three guitars at the bottom of the back cover, those are mainly what you're hearing through a little Gibson GA 20 amp. And that's it.
All right. Sounds good.
Nice talking to you, Jason. Thank you so much.
Nice talking to you. Bye.